Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to be joined by Thomas LeCocq. He's a professor of history at Grandview University. He looks at the nexus between apocalyptic religion and political violence dating back from the Middle Ages to the present. He's going to talk to us about some relevant things that are happening right now. But first, I need to unload a couple of things I've had in various tabs in my browser. So some news you may have missed. The pundits are already starting to drive me a little crazy with their lazy takes on 2024. But the 2022 midterms aren't yet in the books. They're not over. In addition to the Senate runoff in Georgia, which is looking good for Raphael Warnock, the Democrat, I think, a handful of House races are still being counted or recounted. But we are getting close to having a complete picture of how the parties fared. And I think it's worth noting that Democrats finally have started taking down ballot races seriously, and the results are remarkable. They're notable. We know that the Republicans, you know, quote, underperformed in federal elections. That's the conventional wisdom. As regular listeners know, they didn't undershoot my expectations, but they did expose a lot of lazy pundits for relying on conventional wisdom instead of opening their eyes and seeing what was going on around them. But I don't think it sunk in how well Democrats did at the state and local levels. Daniel Nakanian, the editor of Bolts magazine, who's been on this show in the past, did an analysis looking at all 6,000 state legislative races that were up in 2022. And he found that Republicans, as the out party, at a time when most Americans say the country is headed in the wrong track, netted only 22 seats out of 6,000, right? So basically, Democrats held almost across the board. But that's not really the story because, you know, you don't have a big legislature with 6,000 seats. The real story is about state legislative chambers, governorships, and to a lesser degree, you know, secretaries of state races and judicial races. Democrats netted two new governorships, and they did it by flipping three Republican states, Maryland, Massachusetts, and Arizona. The last one is obviously crucial in terms of the 2024 election and maintaining a certain degree of maintaining some legitimacy in those elections. They lost one gubernatorial seat in Nevada, but in that state, they'll continue to control both legislative chambers. So that's not going to just turn into like a hard right government overnight. They flipped control of both chambers of the Michigan legislature. That's a big deal. Also crucial for presidential elections. They flipped the Minnesota Senate, which creates a Democratic trifecta. So now Democrats control the governorship and both legislative chambers in Minnesota. They flipped the Pennsylvania Assembly. This is another key swing state. They kind of flipped the Alaska Senate, although not really. They're now going to have a bipartisan leadership group. Basically, the Alaskan State Senate has a small number of right-wingers who are so crazy that they refuse to like keep things running and vote for budgets and stuff like that. So basically, I think it's 22 seats, something like that. All of the Democrats, all of the Republicans who were willing to just do their jobs came together in a coalition. So they're going to have like seventeen Republicans and Democrats are going to be part of the leadership, or part of this bipartisan leading coalition. And then the five Republicans who just refuse to govern are going to be in the minority. Democrats also made significant gains in other key states, including New Hampshire, Colorado. They also secured a supermajority in Vermont, which has a liberal Republican as governor, probably one of the last of his kind in America, I would imagine. They prevented the GOP from gaining super majorities in North Carolina, which is really important, and Wisconsin, which is really important, and in Nebraska. And they maintained their supermajority in New York. The importance of all that, along with securing key victories over MAGA crackpots running for Secretary of State offices and attorneys general, just can't be overstated. And we have to keep showing up for down ballot races like we did this year. Absolutely have to. And we've talked about this in over the years. Like this has been the result of a significant focus by Democrats on down ballot races for the first time, right? So that like eyes were opened and investments were made and they are paying dividends. So that's some positive stuff. In other news, COVID is still very much among us. I find it kind of depressing that the government has gone completely AWOL in attempting to mitigate the spread of the disease, which is officially resulting in around 2,000 mostly preventable deaths per week in the U.S. And you would never know this just from the way the media has covered the issue and the way people talk about it. The real number, using excess deaths over the average in pre-COVID years, is no doubt much, much higher. Probably, well, I'm not going to guess, but at various points, it's been estimated that it was double the official death toll, so maybe 4,000 per week. And the government is just out of the business of worrying about COVID. It seems that way. And I get it to a degree, right? People are tired. I'm tired. Public health officials have been subjected to 2 years of abuse, more than 2 years. And the Biden administration, they know the public is exhausted. And I don't want to create some false equivalence between Biden and Trump when it comes to pandemic denial, because they're not the same thing. And Biden is obviously operating in a time when people have vaccines and choice, and the hospitals are not being overwhelmed at present. So it's a different situation. But here's the thing. You can drop the mandates and perhaps lower the temperature a bit. I don't know. But an infectious disease did not go away just because the president declares that it's over. And again, the thing that I find so frustrating is that there is almost no public outreach or education campaigns now urging people to voluntarily mask up in crowded indoor spaces. Like, okay, drop the mandate. But where is the public education about how important it is to keep masking up? It's such a simple intervention. There is no public health campaign urging people to get tested before visiting vulnerable family members. We're going to have a lot of people getting sick needlessly over the remainder of the holidays. What passes for a vaccination campaign is pathetic. It's pathetic. There is no vaccination campaign. Most of those who are dying right now are over the age of 65 and have not had a booster, right? Only one quarter of American seniors have had even one booster shot, which makes us an outlier among industrialized countries. You go to another rich country and you're going to find much, much higher rates of boosted, vaccinated elderly people. So what this means is those who were vaccinated early on were probably protected against a variant that is no longer dominant, and their immunity has waned. That happens over time. It finally happened. Someone recently gave me a hard time for wearing a mask on public transport. This was after I'd been stuck in traffic for like 2.5 hours. This fucking woman had the nerve to like make some comment. And she said, "We're all going to die someday." That was her argument for not wearing a mask. As if that's a coherent claim. As if you shouldn't wear a seatbelt when you drive, because we're all going to die someday. You know, light up a cigarette around the gas pumps, because we're all going to die someday, right? And this is frustratingly stupid for obvious reasons, but there's another reason, which is that death is not the only outcome that is problematic with COVID, right? There was a study from the Center for Economic and Policy Research released earlier this month. Sorry, it's December 1st when I'm recording this. It was released last month on the effects of long COVID, which is defined as COVID with symptoms that last for 3 months or longer. And this study found that of the 119 million adults who have received a positive COVID-19 diagnosis through the end of September or whatever, 15% reported long COVID symptoms. Currently, they 15% report currently having long COVID symptoms. 30% have had them at some point. And when you extrapolate this out, they found that it's about 4.5 million adults reported having current long COVID symptoms that reduce their ability to carry out day-to-day activities by a lot. And another 10 million that said, yes, this reduces their ability to participate in daily activities somewhat to a degree. So 15 million people about currently have long COVID, and that's impacting their ability to do daily activities. And that's a significant chunk of the working population. That's not nothing. It's also pretty easy to forget how effective masking is. And we often hear that kids are fine. You don't have to worry about them getting COVID. But there was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine this last month in November that looked at schools in neighboring districts within the same state, Massachusetts, after the state lifted its statewide mask mandate for schools, right? What they did was they left the decision of whether to eliminate mask mandates to the individual school district. So they lifted the statewide mandate and said, well, if you're in a school district, district leaders can choose to maintain it. So this gave researchers a great opportunity to see what the effects were in neighboring school districts, right? Here's what they found. I will quote. This was all within the greater Boston area. So among school districts that lifted masking requirements, they saw an additional 45 COVID cases per 1,000 students and staff during the 15-week period after the policy was lifted. And this is in one school district. Oh, no, this is in... Sorry, so this is in school districts that lifted the mask in the greater Boston area, in one city. And this estimate corresponded to an additional 12,000 COVID cases, which was a third of the cases in those school districts, right? So a third of all of the cases, so in school and outside of school, resulted from lifting these mask mandates. And the additional cases in those communities translated to a minimum of approximately 17,000 missed school days for students and 6,500 missed school days for the staff during this 15-week period. Again, just over a 15-week period, just over the school districts in the Boston area. So you can kind of wrap your head around how great the effect of masking indoors in crowded spaces would be across the whole population. It's huge. But nobody's even encouraging people to do that voluntarily. And there's actually peer pressure out there to not even try to mitigate the spread of COVID, like that lady who gave me a hard time on a train, which, by the way, did not work out the way she wanted it to. But this is where we're at. So we're on our own. We're not getting much guidance from the government. I would urge people to just be smart, wear a mask indoors around people. And if you haven't gotten your bivalent booster, go out and do it. It does protect you from infection, but much more importantly, it prevents serious illness and perhaps fatalities. And with that long intro in the bag, let's move on to the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Thomas Lecoq.
One day, one woman asked him, what do you do to survive? He said, oh my dear, listen here. this is what he cried. On my feet I wear two shoes for dancing, dancing to be free. On my feet they're paying tribute to the Bobby Marley legacy. On my knees they got some cuts and bruises from my skating all my days. Cause when I'm skating with my friends, my troubles drift away. I say my legs they're wearing baggy pants. I like to move around cause getting down and jumping out. These are some good things that I found.
Welcome back. I'm happy to be joined now by Thomas Lecoq. Although I wish we were to discuss something less depressing than the predictable wave of violence against the LGBTQ community that has resulted from the right's propaganda about drag queen story outer hours and this vicious slander that they are, quote, groomers. Professor Lecoq is a historian at Grandview University, where he focuses on the very old nexus between apocalyptic religion and political violence. And Thomas had a piece this week at Religion Dispatches titled, "Not Only Is the Right Unapologetic for Violent Anti-LGBTQ Plus Rhetoric, It's Doubling Down." You can read it at religiondispatches.org. Thomas, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. One of the 600 plus mass shootings this year occurred a couple of weeks ago at a gay bar in Colorado Springs called Club Q, as I'm sure all listeners know. It went down the same night as a drag queen event was scheduled. According to reports, the suspect, 22-year-old, they're always so young, 22-year-old Anderson Lee Aldrich, entered the club and immediately started firing from his AR-15, the weapon of choice for mass shooters, and would likely have killed many more people than the five who perished had he not been wrestled to the ground and subdued by a couple of heroic bystanders. Thomas, the headline of your piece gets to something I found especially disturbing about this incident. It seems to me that after similar incidents in the past, after murderous rampages inspired by eliminationist rhetoric on the right, there was a playbook that the right kind of followed. It was deny and deflect. You say the shooter was really apolitical, or you say the shooter was actually a deranged liberal. You say that the story should be about mental health and accuse people of politicizing the tragedy. You engage in whataboutism of various stripes. This is what we've seen consistently after the Walmart massacre in El Paso, after Dylan Roof's killing spree in the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, etc., etc. While we have seen some of that, this time just feels very different. Can you talk about what you mean by doubling down, and what should we make of this apparent shift in terms of the reaction from the right?
So it's been a long year of this. This has been kind of a very, it's not that calls for violence against the LGBTQIA plus community are new. Unfortunately, they're very, very old. This is a long form, viciously anti-gay campaign that has lots of baggage on the right, and they have been doing for a very long time. But you're right that usually when it comes to direct violence, there's the discussion of mental health, there is the claims of lone wolf, there's the deflecting it to someone else. This summer, we had just waves of calls for violence, either rhetorical calls or calls for physical violence against the transgender community, which led to bomb threats against children's hospitals that were providing puberty blockers to trans youth. And because they were bomb threats and no bombs went off, they never backed down. This was a continuous call for either society defending itself, but defending itself in a way that implies violence against the LGBTQIA plus community, or continued rhetoric about hospitals, about child mutilation, about groomers, about all of this kind of traditional rhetoric. The actual physical attacks against LGBTQIA plus groups and against things like drag queen story hours, it was a big movement this summer, right? I think we all remember the June arrest of 31 members of Patriot Front in Coeur d'Alene who were showing up to attack a Pride event. And that was just one of a large number of far-right attacks on Pride events just in June alone.
Yeah.
The difference, though, it feels like, is that these attacks are we've gotten to the point in the United States where mass shootings are so common that if it doesn't hit a certain level of violence, we ignore it. So physical attacks on LGBTQIA plus events, if they don't involve shootings, don't seem to register in the news outside of local news anymore.
Right. Right?
Bomb threats register briefly, but because there aren't actually bombs, they go away really quickly. So the Club Q shooting is a targeted attack at a gay bar, specifically a mass shooting against the LGBTQ community. Five people are killed. 19, I think the last count I saw, 19 people were injured. And it's not that there isn't a reaction against this, right? It's just that you always expect there to be some kind of attempt at building plausible deniability, some kind of pushback that like, oh, well, how could you say that this is our fault? This is just, you know, this is a lone wolf. This is, you know, mental illness. This is something like that. But the people have been pushing this rhetoric, the kind of online accounts, especially that have been pushing this rhetoric all year, have instead really doubled down on it. So Libs of TikTok, which I assume that your listeners are familiar with Libs of TikTok, but if they're not, it's a person named Chaya Raichik who runs Libs of TikTok on a variety of social media that basically targets leftists in theory, but really a huge amount of anti-LGBTQIA hate against individuals, against groups, against locations, and turns her followers towards them. She completely ignored the Club Q attack, but the next day she went ahead and just kept doing the exact same thing she'd been doing, putting up pictures of drag show education organizations and individuals who appear at their events, calling them out by name, putting up, you know, in pictures from an individual's TikTok writing, this person doesn't identify as a human, but as an inanimate object. So, quote, it uses its pronouns, which is dehumanizing rhetoric, which leads to stochastic terrorism. Right. Matt Walsh, who is very deep into kind of anti-trans far-right punditry, he calls gender-affirming care evil. He did talk about the politicalization, but his comment was, leftists are using a mass shooting to try and blackmail us into accepting the castration and sexualization of children. These people are just beyond evil. I have never felt more motivated to oppose everything they stand for with every fiber of my being. Despicable scumbags. This is his response to the murder of five people. It's groomer rhetoric, and it's talking about leftists as despicable scumbags and effectively arguing that the mass shooting
was justified.
Is justified.
Yeah.
And this is actually the from this particular branch of kind of online far-right punditry, this is the dominant reaction, right? How dare you try to politicize this thing that they totally had coming?
I really need to stress for listeners who don't pay close attention to this stuff that this is institutional. It's mainstream on the right. There are literally groups that are funded by billionaires in Texas and stuff that put out alarms, that put out calls for armed thugs to protest outside children's story hours and stuff like that. And it's a constant, there's a constant drumbeat of this. It's really vile. You write of the groomer slur, and I quote, what it's designed to do is maximize rhetorical violence to desensitize people to future physical violence, which is as close to the definition of stochastic terrorism as you can get. You continue, and again, I quote, it isn't as simple as saying this is a Christian movement that hates the LGBTQIA plus. Jesus, you've got all the LGBTQ. I'm just going to go LGBTQ because I can't do it all. Community, this is a much broader coalition bringing together a wide range of far-right ideologies that have very disparate goals and aggressive disagreements about most things, but the coalition of far-right groups meet in the culture wars, and they especially meet around their mutual hatred of the LGBTQIA plus community. I think you can In recent months or recent years, you could probably add Jews to that. Can you expand on that? Because I think it's an important point that not all these people are true believers in a radical vision of Christianity or Christian nationalism. There is a convenience factor as well.
There is. So I think when we look at this kind of broad far-right coalition, it feels very comfortable to try to come up with a singular cause. Why are people acting this way? Well, let's find one simple cause, and then we have a direct target, and then we can try to do something about this one thing. And that would be nice, but history is not as simple and pleasant as giving us singular causes for most things. So the groups of people who fall into the broader kind of Christo-fascist or Christian nationalist sphere are part of it. But you also have groups that are more involved in kind of, I don't know, secular fascism. You have people who are simply virulent homophobes. You have the alt-right trolls. You do have far-right evangelicals. You have non-Christian cultural conservatives. You have people who are simply hate mongers. You have people who, for this is a career. But all of them have found that the language of using hatred of specific groups of people who have conveniently for them been othered repeatedly in contemporary American history allows them to cast a wide net and draw in a lot of people to listen to them. Right. So it's not that I think that a group like Patriot Front, who are just straight up Nazis,
yeah,
not subtle Nazis, they're just straight up Nazis. I mean, it's a fascist on an American flag. Like, these are people that, when they tell you who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
It's not that they would be able to build a coherent government with someone like Franklin Graham in the aftermath of destroying American democracy, right? These are not people who meet on a level of how do you rebuild society on the other hand, but they both hate gay people an awful lot and they can meet on that level. And so it's overt hatred of the gay community and especially overt hatred of transgender people is a place where they can put aside all of their much wider differences and come together in violence, rhetorical yeah. and physical violence. And there are other places. I think the point about anti-Semitism is really important, but anti-Semitism, there are always nuances and wrinkles in the language they bring into it, because some of them, I mean, the Nazis are very overt in the fact that they just hate Jews. They're Nazis. This is part of it. Other people want to use coded language and dog whistles, and they want to, you know, use the globalist cosmopolitans or all the kinds of other nonsense anti-Semitic dog whistles that people like to use because they don't want to be overtly considered Nazis. They don't seem to have a problem with being really overt in their hatred for the LGBT community.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think it's worth noting here that while there are some prominent Republicans or some prominent conservative leaders who push back on the conspiracy theories about stolen elections and stuff like that. And there are even some who push back on the anti-Semitism that's been flourishing on the right. You saw that recently with Trump's dinner with Nick Fuentes, the neo-fascist scumbag. I can't think of any who have condemned this deadly rhetoric against LGBTQ people. Maybe you can come up with an example or two, but let me ask you this. What is the significance of the fact that there isn't any kind of elite pushback from the right?
I think it's you see where people view their base, right? I think that this is one of the things I hate to believe that everyone is so mercenary that they're just trying to play politics, but it's either we believe that the majority of politicians on the right are simply virulent homophobes who support this. And I do think that's going too far. Or we accept the fact that they think that this is red meat for the base and they're worried about pushing back too hard.
Yeah.
And that worries me much more. And I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I think because of the system that we've put in place for how elections function, people are much more worried about their primaries than they are about general elections in this country.
Yes. Yes.
And given that most of the challenges, certainly right now in GOP primaries, are from fringe candidates even further to the right, not rocking the boat in things that seem to play well for primary voters makes a horrific kind of atrocity calculus.
I'm just going to kind of like go a little bit further here, though, because you know, all of those calculations that you're talking about are also true for 2020 election denialism. And what you saw in this last cycle, this last midterm cycle, is a lot of Republican office holders saying, nah, this was a fair election. We're not going to do this again. And that pushback, again, elite pushback, I think helped ameliorate. I mean, we have seen some scattered claims of fraud in the 2022 election, the midterm election, but it has been much smoother than a lot of us worried about. And part of the reason is that it wasn't something that was just accepted at all levels of the conservative movement. So I think it's important to note the distinction. Let me take a step back, because there's a lot going on in this story about this actual shooting. And I want to just touch on a few things before I let you go. CNN reported that people who knew him said that Aldrich was obsessed with guns and violence, of course, and spouted anti-gay bigotry freely. Also racism, right? Of course, yeah. You get it all. It's all big enchilada of bigotry. What do you make of Aldrich then claiming to be non-binary?
So I've read enough reports that have suggested that nobody who knew him had ever heard of this before, that this is the first time this has ever been claimed, that he used he, him pronouns, and that I do not know the man. I don't want to make comments on other people's gender choices. I would say that the immediate response by far-right provocateurs is to claim that this could not possibly be connected to anti-LGBT hate as a result of this, and that's complete nonsense. So I, not knowing the man, I cannot comment on his own personal life. I find that people immediately latch onto this as evidence that it couldn't possibly be the huge amounts of aggressive anti-LGBTQ rhetoric in the air that caused this, as if gender identity means that you are not susceptible to a rhetoric that suggests that all of these events are grooming events and that in order to defend society and children, you have to shoot them.
Yes.
It's the reduction of human beings to a singular facet of their identity. So let's give him the benefit of the doubt. And let's say that he's non-binary. I know. I hate it. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say that, that this is true and that he's non-binary. Yeah. That does not mean that he cannot also be a virulent homophobe who, listening to all of this rhetoric, decided to pick up his guns and go defend Western civilization by murdering people.
Right.
And I think it's because people collapse identity into a singular facet and are unable to conceive the idea that people are multifaceted beings. I'm sorry, you can have deep conflicts about your own identity and still decide to engage in spectacular acts of violence. The same kind of rhetoric is being passed around in far-right spaces about Chase Staub, who was arrested for making threats at LGBTQ clubs in Atlanta.
Right. I mean, so I appreciate and respect your caution. I'm not so cautious, and I will just say that, you know, there is a thing on the right where they say, oh, you can identify as anything. And it's a for me, it's a clear troll, right? I mean, like,
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a clear troll. I think it's absolute bullshit. I mean, if we're going to go with my personal opinion, it's complete unmitigated bullshit, and it is very aggressively a trolling. But even if it wasn't a trolling,
right,
it's still bullshit.
Right. No, I agree with that point. I think it's important to understand that people have multiple overlapping identities. They're not always consistent. We reduce identity to, you know, gender identity or sexual preference, but like, you can have a right-wing liberal arts college professor. That's a conflicted identity, right? You know, there are lefty SWAT cops, right?
Yeah.
There are many of us have multiple and overlapping and at times conflicting identities. Then according to CNN and other outlets, Aldrich was accused of breaking into his mother's place and threatening her with a bomb. That was just last year. There was a standoff with police. According to press reports, it's unclear how that case was dismissed, but no charges were filed. No formal charges were filed. This is, again, like a white guy in a standoff with a bomb threat. Yeah. We don't know what happened. That means that the incident would not have shown up on a background check required to buy guns. This is an important point, I think, because Colorado has a red flag law, which allows a judge to order the confiscation of guns from people who are deemed to be a high risk of violence. And because that case was sealed, that 2021 case was sealed, we have no idea if those laws could have been invoked under the circumstances and perhaps spared some lives. So there's a lot that we still don't know about this story.
Yeah.
Thomas, before I let you go, I have one more kind of difficult question. What do you think decent people should do in the face of these threats?
I think you have to stand with the LGBTQIA+ community.
Do you think that includes armed defense?
You know what? It's
this is difficult, isn't it?
It's a really difficult thing, right? Functionally, I do not believe that we should have an armed civilian population. I think that it's very clear that an armed civilian population creates more problems than it solves. But in the face of the armed marches by fascists across the country, in the face of armed violence, it's hard to argue with groups like the John Brown Gun Club who show up in solidarity and defense of these events.
Yeah.
I never think the solution is more guns, but the solution is apparently also not any of the other things. I think at the very least, there has to be an aggressive societal pushback on this rhetoric everywhere that it happens, on TV, on social media, on, you know, every online space, every media space, talking to politicians, showing up to vote against people who support this kind of thing. But it's clear that that's not enough. And since the government cannot, because of the way we've designed hate speech laws, step in to do something about it, people have to figure out where they can support and defend the LGBTQIA plus community. For some people, that may mean standing, exercising their Second Amendment rights, which is very, very popular when the right does it in armed marches. I guess it's certainly a reasonable option for people on the left to do as well. I also think that on a very basic level, when you encounter this rhetoric in your own life with the people you know, you have to push back at it. You have to stomp it out immediately. This is rhetoric that incites people to murder.
Yeah.
And we have to fight that everywhere we find it.
Yeah, I think that that's as good an answer as you're going to get. It makes me deeply uncomfortable to think that we're headed down a path where we have dueling, like, armed militias. But the point of all of this is to force LGBTQ people, but also their allies, liberal people, to intimidate and force them out of public life. And I don't think you can allow them to get away with that. And if they're gonna and try to intimidate people, then, you know, having some sort of defense is justified and perhaps required. And maybe there needs to be more thought to, you know, hiring professionals who are trained and whose job is to provide security rather than have just militias go by and stand by these events. But in any event, Thomas Lukacs, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
No, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate you you letting me be on.
Folks, read Thomas's piece. It's over at Religion Dispatches. That's .org, not .com. It's called "Not Only Is the Right Unapologetic for Violent Anti-LGBTQ Plus Rhetoric, It's Doubling Down." I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. Oh, you can follow me on various social media sites. I don't know how long I'll be on Twitter. But you can also subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.